So again, welcome to the Big Book Workshop. I was approached and said, Roberta, you like to do workshops. Would you like to do a workshop on the Big Book? And I said, sure. And so I asked a couple friends, so what do you think I should talk about? And what I decided to talk about was, what is the Big Book? Who wrote it? Why was it written? When was it written? Some interesting facts around it. And then near the last half of the workshop, it's going to be interactive. And on each of your chairs, I have put a little bookmark that I had gathered in my recovery journey along the way. I don't know who gave it to me years ago. But it's just a little index about topics in the Big Book. And so I'll be asking you guys to come to the microphone later on if you want to share from a topic, and I have my Big Book here. I'll ask you to, if you do sign and make a recording, to sign the waiver, or if there is something that prevents you from recording, I'll make sure that gets edited out. So no one has to use the microphone if they don't want to. Let me also preface this by saying, this is my understanding. I am not a historian. I am not a professional person who studies the Big Book. I'm just a compulsive eater who was asked to do a workshop, so I could be wrong in anything that I'm sharing with you. And if I am, I welcome you to prove me wrong and find the actual answer in the literature yourself. And thank you for appreciating that I'm just an amateur with this. So with that being said, let me start. This is going to be a storytelling afternoon, so hopefully I don't put you too much to sleep, but I want to tell you the story of the Big Book. So first off, let me send you back to September 1933, and Bill W., one of the founders of AA, was admitted to town hospital for withdrawal from alcoholism. While he was there, he met Dr. Silkworth. Dr. Silkworth had been a pretty good doctor, but had fallen on hard times, and the town hospital was the place where he got a job, and that's how the two met. And Dr. Silkworth was unique in that most of the people thought alcoholism was a lack of willpower or a lack of moral character or a sin. And he actually had the revolutionary idea that it was actually an illness, that alcoholism was an illness, and it was a two-part illness. It was an illness of the body, meaning that the body had an allergy, and it was an illness of the mind, that the mind had an obsession. And both of those, the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind, made alcoholics powerless. And that was his belief. And so while Bill W. was there that summer of 33, he got restored and he got better and he got out and he went and he drank again. And he was readmitted to town hospital the following summer of 1934, and Dr. Silkworth met him again and pronounced him to his wife that he was incurable. And then he was let go. And then that December of 1934, while he was home, he had the conversation with his friend Ebby. His friend Ebby, who was also an alcoholic, had come over to visit him. And Bill was looking forward to it because here's his drinking buddy to come over. However, when Ebby came over, Ebby had been sober for a couple months. And while he was there in the kitchen of Bill's home, shared with him the spiritual experience that he had had and talked about the group he had been part of called the Oxford Group, which had a series of moral principles. And that's the setting that AA was founded in. And it was, the founders were Bill W. and Dr. Bob. And in the summer of 35, that's when the groups first started. And they, on their own, tried and failed and learned from their mistakes and started the fellowship. And there were two fellowships that they had, one in New York and one in Akron, Ohio. And so that was the initial founding of AA. Now, early on, they realized, and this was probably about the summer of 37, they had about 40 sober members, and it occurred to them, you know, we think we found something here. We think we have found a way of life that can help others. And they wanted to get this in writing to communicate this to the public, to say there is a solution. And so in the spring of 1938, they asked Bill W. to start the work on the book, on the first draft. At the time that he started writing the book, and it wasn't only Bill W. that wrote it, but he was the first author, and then it was edited. He had only been sober 3.5 years. Dr. Bob had been sober less than 3 years, and by that point, there were about 100 other members at the time. One of the things that the group realized was that in order to get the book out there, they had to have testimonials. They had to have people who had actually been alcoholics and recovered. And so in the Akron group, Dr. Bob and Jim, who was another recovering member, who was a newspaper man and familiar with writing, interviewed the 18 members of the people in Akron and said, tell me your story. And they told him their story, and they wrote him down, and they got 18 stories. For the people in New York, where Bill mainly was, they said to the people, well, write your own story. So the other people wrote their own story. But then Bill and somebody else didn't think it was good enough and started editing it, to which point some of those members were like, well, who do you think you are editing my story? But ultimately, Bill W. and the other gentleman got it edited, and they had a group of stories that they could put in. So in the spring of 1939, the book was published. And again, there were two arms to the fellowship. There was the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then there was the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. The title of the book initially was, they called themselves a nameless group of alcoholics, and so that's where the name Alcoholics Anonymous came from, and that was kicked around early on as a possible name for the book. But they also liked the name The Way Out. The Way Out was the name of the book that a lot of people liked, but when they went and looked at the Library of Congress, there were 12 other books called The Way Out, and they didn't want this to be the 13th book on The Way Out, and so they settled on the name Alcoholics Anonymous. So interesting facts about the book I wanted to share. Again, the official title, and I have a really beaten up version of fourth edition, the official title, and you'll actually see it on here, is called Alcoholics Anonymous, The Story of How Many Thousands of Men and Women Have Recovered from Alcoholism. So that's actually, as far as I can tell, the full title. It's not just Alcoholics Anonymous, it's Alcoholics Anonymous, The Story of How Many Thousands of Men and Women Have Recovered from Alcoholism. It's generally known as the Big Book because when they first published it in 1939, the thickness of the paper made it look really big. And like true alcoholics, if a little is good, more would be better. And so that's why they called it the Big Book. And from what I understand, here's a picture of the first cover, what the cover looked like, big and red, and so the people could see that coming. It's one of the best-selling books of all time, and there are about 30 million copies that have been sold of the Big Book. It's been translated to 68 languages. Since in 2011, Time magazine placed the book on its list of 100 best and most influential books written in English since 1923, which is when the magazine Time started. In 2012, the Library of Congress here in the U.S. designated it as one of the 88 books that shaped America, so it's had a great impact on our culture. The first edition was printed in 1939, and they printed 5,000 copies initially. Ultimately, it turned into 300,000, and there were about 100 members when it was first published. The second edition was 1955, and there was about 1.1 million copies. The third edition was 1976, with about 20 million copies. And at that point, there were about 6,000 AA groups and 150,000 members. The fourth edition was published in 2001. And as of January 2013, there were about 114,000 groups and 2 million members of AA alone, let alone all the countless other 12 steps that have come from that. Now, I wanted to give a little bit of background about how the Big Book is organized, and the best way to do that is to look at the title page. For the most part, when I first got the book, I jumped right into how it works, chapter 5. But there's actually a whole bunch of stuff at the very beginning. And it says, the way it's organized is you have a preface to this edition, and then it actually shows you the foreword to the fourth edition, the foreword to the third edition, to the second and the first. So you get a sense of what people were thinking when it was first published. This is what they were trying to do. They're trying to share the message. And then you have something really interesting called the doctor's opinion. All of these sections are in Roman numerals at the very front, which kind of implies they're not that important, which is really unfortunate because, if anything, I think the doctor's opinion is the most important part of this book. Originally, it was not part of the italicized numbers. It was first part of the actual numbered pages. But for whatever reason, and I didn't figure out why, they moved it to the Roman numeral part. But why that's significant is Dr. Silkworth was the doctor that they went to say, could you give us your opinion on alcoholism? And he shared that he thought it was a illness of the mind, it was an allergy, and an obsession, illness of the body and an obsession of the mind. However, in the first edition of the book, he didn't want his name on it because he thought he was going to get laughed out of medical societies. So in the first edition, it's called The Doctor. doctor's opinion. In subsequent editions, it actually does reference, okay, it was Silkworth, because by that time, the medical profession had said, you know, he's right. And so he felt okay putting his name on it after that. So another reason the doctor's opinion is important is it describes the problem. If I don't know as a compulsive eater, if I don't identify as a compulsive eater, I don't know I need a solution. And so the doctor's opinion, which says as a compulsive eater, I have an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind, is important. That's step one. Step two, which is the next part of the book, is there is a solution. There is a solution to this. There is a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity. And then all the other chapters talk about, well, how do I get that power? And as I was preparing for this workshop, I've read the Big Book several times. I've listened to studies on the Big Book. But I was really blessed to be reminded that I have a problem, that there is a solution, and there's an actual program of action I can take. And that's what this program tells me about. And it matches the steps. Step one, I am powerless over my eating disorder. Step two, I come to believe there's a power greater than me that can restore me to sanity. And step three, made a decision to turn my life, and then all the other steps tell me what to do. I do an inventory, I share it with my sponsor, I ask for the willingness, you know, all the steps. So the doctor's opinion, and then again it goes through more about alcoholism and then how it works. So then there's a section about how it works, and then the next section is stories. Now, when they first published the Big Book, again, they went to the members that were there in 1939 in Akron in New York, and most of them were bottom Skid Row drunks, right? Well, in the subsequent editions, the fellowship had changed. There were more women, there were other ages, people hadn't hit rock bottom. And so for subsequent editions, they realized they needed different types of people. So the first edition has the original set of stories. The second edition has it slightly different stories to represent more the population of the society, and et cetera. So that's why there's some differences between first, second, and third editions. Now, there's other things in here that are interesting. After the personal stories, at the end, I'd never really looked at the back. So let me give you a quick overview of what's in the back. These are all the appendices. One of the appendices is, it's called the AA tradition. And in my book, it's page 561. And this is, it talks about, among other things, the long form of the 12 traditions. I didn't even know there was a long form of the 12 traditions. Let me give you an example. It says, our AA experience has taught us that, one, each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of the great whole. AA must continue to live, or most of us will surely die. Hence, our common welfare should come first, but individual welfare follows close afterwards. So again, it's just a little bit more information. So that was kind of interesting back there. Of course, probably the most famous appendices is the spiritual experience, where it says earlier on, what the heck is a spiritual experience? So that's back there too. There's also the medical view on AA, where you get other medical professionals weighing in on what do they think about alcoholism. There's also the religious views about different people from different religions saying, we think this is okay. How many of you have heard of the Lasker Award? Have any of you heard of that? Maybe a couple of you had. I hadn't heard of it. I only saw it because I was thinking, I need to know what's in this book if I'm doing a workshop on it. And so at the back here, let me read you what it says. This is on page 571. The Lasker Award. In 1951, the Lasker Award was given Alcoholics Anonymous. The citation reads in part as follows. The American Public Health Association presents a Lasker Group Award for 1951 to Alcoholics Anonymous in recognition of its unique and highly successful approach to that age-old public health and social problem, alcoholism. In emphasizing alcoholism as an illness, the social stigma associated with this condition is being blotted out. Historians may one day recognize Alcoholics Anonymous to have been a great venture in social pioneering, which forged a new instrument for social action, a new therapy based on the kinship of common suffering, one having a vast potential for the myriad other ills of mankind. So I thought, well, that's nice. I wonder what else has the Lasker Award given? So I went online, and I was shocked to find out that the Lasker Award was not referencing, for 1951, this award. And I was immediately going to jump on that and say, look what I found, something inconsistent. And then I realized that this was the Lasker Group Award that was being given in the 1950s. They discontinued that shortly thereafter, but they continued to give the Lasker Award to other organizations that do good things and people that do good things. So again, never heard of them, but they're still alive and well today, and they're referenced in the Big Book. I thought that was interesting. So that's kind of the overview of just real quick what's in the Big Book. What I wanted to do next was I wanted to give you just a quick little picture of the people and the bios that wrote the Big Book. And for if you can see, many of you have probably already seen this. This is a picture of Bill W. That was him. Let me give you a little bit of his bio. His name was William Griffith Wilson, born November 26, 1895 in Vermont, and he died January 24, 1971 at age 75. His spouse was Lois W. So that was Bill W. And then Dr. Bob. Here's a picture of Dr. Bob. His full name was Robert Holbrook Smith. He was born August 8, 1879 in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. He died November 16, 1950 at age 71. His wife's name was Ann Smith. So that's Dr. Bob. And then I wanted to show Dr. Silkworth, or known as Silky. I guess they called him Silky. And his full name was William Duncan Smith, and he was born in 1873, and he died in 1951. And again, he was the director of the Charlestown's Hospital for Drug and Alcohol Addiction in New York City in the 30s, during the time when Bill Wilson was there. He was a graduate of Princeton University, had a medical degree from New York University Bellevue Medical School. He treated 40,000 alcoholics during his career, and the last years were at Knickerbocker Hospital in New York. So that's a little bit and pictures about them. The next thing I wanted to do is read from, tell you some of the story in Bill's own terms about how the book came to be written. This is from Alcoholics Anonymous, Comes of Age. We have some of our questions based on this book, which honestly is the only reason I even had this book in my possession. But it's a little bit of a reading, but again, it's a story, and it's going to pick up on page 153, and again, this is conference-approved literature, so I'm allowed to cite it. So again, this is Bill W. talking about how the Big Book was written. Sometime in March or April 1938, I began to work on what was to become the book Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time our big money push was underway, I had completed my own story and had roughed out what is now the second chapter of the book. Mimeographed copies of these two chapters were part of the paraphernalia for money-raising operation, which had now fizzled out. Anxious to encourage us, our friends insisted on monthly trustee meetings. For a while, nothing happened at them except commiseration for the fact that the foundation's empty, the treasury was empty. But at one of those meetings in the early fall of 1938, Frank Amos popped up with the idea which opened the door upon our real future. Frank said, "One of my friends, Eugene Exman, is a religious editor of Harper. Perhaps he would be interested in your new book. Why don't you go down there and see and show him a few chapters you've done here? I'll fix it up for you." So I went down to meet Gene Exman, another wonderful friendship to be of our society. I related the tale of our struggles and handed over to him my first attempts at authorship. While I waited, Gene thoughtfully scanned the two chapters. Then he asked, "Could you do the whole book in this style? And how many months would it take you?" I was shaking, but I had an answer ready. "I believe I can do it. It will probably take me 9 or 10 months." Thereupon, he made a proposal that was surprising. "If it would help things along," he said, "I think Harper might be willing to advance you $1,500 in royalties. This amount would be deducted from your account when the book is finished in 1939. Again in the clouds, I left Harper to break the great news to the gang. I first headed for a visit with Frank Amos, but on the way there, my elation was disturbed by disquieting thoughts. Suppose our embryo book were someday to become the chief text for our fellowship. Our principal written asset would then be owned by an outside publisher, a fine and conservative one, surely, but nevertheless an outsider. So I wondered if our fellowship should own its own book. Then I thought about the $1,500 of advance royalties. When the book was done, I would still owe Harper that sum, and a good many volumes would have to be sold just to get even. And suppose that when the book appeared, There were to be heavy publicity, and thousands of cries for help from alcoholics and their families began to pour in. We would not have any money to cope with this quite possible situation. I kept these misgivings to myself, and it was good to see Frank's face light up as he heard the news. In any case, it was fine to know that a firm like Harper wanted the book and that an editor of Gene's caliber believed that it was going to be good. This experience was one of the confidence builders that kept the book project going through thick and thin. At the next foundation meeting, our friends smiled happily as they heard the details of the Harper project. It was the first ray of hope we had seen in months. The trustees were unanimous in their opinion, and the Harper deal was the answer. I had shared my doubts with a few New York friends about the Harper proposal, but I said nothing about them elsewhere. Now, very reluctantly, I told the trustees what they were. But our non-alcoholics on the board were not impressed with my reasons. They pointed to the well-known fact that authors seldom publish their own books and get away with it. The meeting ended on a dismal note. We were a hung jury. No conclusion or verdict was reached. Soon thereafterwards, one of the most powerful, terrific and power drivers I've ever met got into the act. That was my friend, Henry P., a one-time Standard Oil executive and the very first alcoholic ever to stay sober even a little while in the New York group. He had been a protege of Dr. Silkworth and a frequent visitor at Towns Hospital. At this time, he had been sober about 2 years. Henry had red hair, at least one new idea a minute, and energy beyond telling. He was not a foundation trustee, and he had no official say at all, but that mattered not a bit. He was a hard-hitting salesman, and he sold his bill of goods. He said, "Look here, Bill, why do we even bother anymore with those trustees and that foundation? Those folks have not raised a cent, and they are not going to. Why don't we put this proposed book on a business basis and form a stock company? Let's sell shares to our own folks right here in New York. If we give them a real argument, I'll guarantee they will get up the dough." Well, I was an ex-Wall Streeter and had already toyed with this notion myself, but Henry had much bigger ideas and he breathed confidence. Our society would organize its own publishing company, and maybe we would have to forget about the foundation. I told him the trustees would never agree to our scheme, and I didn't want to hurt their feelings. But Henry's skin was thicker than mine. He was implacable. He said that it simply had to be done, and I finally agreed. Still much disturbed about the whole business, I went back to Gene Exman and frankly explained to him what was about to happen. To my utter amazement, he agreed, quite contrary to his own interest, that a society like ours ought to control and publish its own literature. Moreover, he felt that very possibly we could do this with success. Though Gene's opinion did not register at all when it was transmitted to the trustees, it did give Henry and me the kind of encouragement we so much needed. Henry wasted no time but started selling the proposition to our New York members at once. He buttonholed them one by one, persuading, browbeating, hypnotizing. I trailed around in his wake, smoothing ruffled feathers and trying to dispel some of the suspicions that had been created about our motives. After a couple weeks of this kind of violent promotion, we got a lukewarm consent from our Eastern membership. Dr. Bob was dubious, but he also consented. He did think it would be unwise at this stage to lay the matter before the Akron membership. Some promotion might be justifiable in New York, but few Akronites would be able to see it, he thought. He felt, too, that we should try the idea out on the Board of Trustees. We simply could not ignore them. Meanwhile, Henry and I were perfecting our plan. It would take a persuasive perspective to induce alcoholics to part with their money for stock in a company that had not even produced one book. But the more we investigated, the better the proposition looked. We went to Edward Blackwell, the president of Cornwall Press, one of the largest printers in the United States. Here we discovered that the printing cost of an average-sized book is only about 10% of its retail price. A 400-page volume could be printed for only a fraction of a dollar. If we were to price our book at $3.50, as Henry and I figured it, this would practically be all net profit. There would be no bookstore commission, no paid advertising, and none of the usual losses that publishers had to take on books that did not sell. Our book, of course, would sell, and we would not fail to clean up. It looked too good to be true. I laid this information before the next trustees meeting. I anticipated that the reaction would be bad, and it certainly was. To flatly disagree with these wonderful friends was the toughest possible assignment. Once more, the trustees' meeting adjourned without agreement. I knew we would have to go through with this deal despite all the objections. It was depressing. But Henry was not depressed. He had been sitting up nights working on a prospectus. The main arguments were these. Harper had said the book was going to be a good one. And even if we paid our groups and outside bookstores a dollar a book for distribution, there would still be a whopping profit margin. The book could be printed at very low cost and sold for $250 wholesale or $350 by mail order. And when the reviews and other publicity got rolling, we were certain there would be sales by the carload. The prospectus suggested that a company formed with a stock of $25 par value. The New York alcoholics and their friends would buy one-third of these shares for cash. The other two-thirds would be distributed between Henry and me for our work. To mollify the trustees, it was decided that the author's royalty, which would ordinarily be mine, would go to the Alcoholic Foundation. To the prospectus, Henry attached a chart which showed that the estimated profits on sales of 100,000, 500,000, and even 1 million books. I have now quite forgotten just what his hopes were, but they were fantastic. I was not quite so optimistic, but I did feel sure that the proceeds of the book would enable several of us to become full-time workers and to set up a general headquarters for our society. Whether this worked out or not, I was nevertheless convinced that our fellowship ought to own and control its own literature. Our enterprise still lacked two essentials. It was not incorporated, and it did not have a name. Henry took care of these matters. Since the forthcoming volume would only be the first of many such works, he thought our publishing company should be called Works Publishing, Inc. And that was all right with me, but I protested that we had no incorporation on which to base shares, and that incorporation would take money. Next day, I found that Henry had bought a pad of blank stock certificates in a stationery store, and across the top of each certificate had typed this legend, Works Publishing, Inc., par value 25, and at the bottom there was a signature, Henry P., President. When I protested these irregularities, Henry said there was no time to waste. Why be concerned with small details? So the great enterprise was launched. It remained to be seen if it would float. Henry knew every stratagem of the super salesman, and he got right down to work. He descended like a whirlwind on the New York alcoholics and some of their friends, suggesting that they take stock in a glittering new venture. I was no second rater at this sort of thing myself, and I followed right along. Well, we did not even... Well, we did not sell even one of our proposed 600 shares of Works Publishing. Cheap as it was, the New York alcoholic said, "You fellows have certainly got nerve. What made you think that we would buy stock in a book not yet written?" But Henry was not discouraged. He still had ideas. "Bill," he said, "you know, you and I both know this book is going to sell, and Harper thinks it will sell, but these New York drunks just do not believe it. Some take it as a joke, and the rest talk high and holy about mixing a spiritual enterprise with money and promotion. But if they really did think that the book would sell, they would buy stock all right and fast. So why don't you go up and see the Reader's Digest people and see if they will print a piece about our fellowship in this book. If the Reader's Digest runs an article about us, we will sell these books by the carloads. Anybody can see that, even these tightwad drunks. So what are we waiting for? Let's go." 2 days later, at Pleasantville, New York, we sat in the office of Mr. Kenneth Payne, then managing editor of the Digest. We drew a glowing picture of our fellowship and its book to be. We mentioned the high interest Mr. Rockefeller and some of his friends had, and Mr. Payne was interested. After a while, he said, "I'm almost sure the Payne would like to handle this story, though, of course, I'll have to check it with the other editors. Personally, I think it's just the sort of thing we're looking for. When your book is ready next spring, let me know, and I think we can put a feature writer to work. This could be a great story, but I just got to check it with the staff first. That's understood, isn't it?" Henry and I reached for our hats and sped to New York. Now we had real ammunition. That very night, we started a fresh canvas, and the former doubters began to sign up. Nearly everybody was broke at the time, so we made things easy for them. They could buy their shares on an installment plan, $5 a month for 5 months for each share. Many could only afford a single share, and when the trustees were brought up to date, they loyally pitched in too. Some AAs had friends who signed up for small amounts. Certain of my old Wall Street cronies tossed in a few chips. People like Dr. Silkworth and Silkworth and Dr. Tyboat lent a hand. Soon we had a subscription of 200 shares, which amounted to $5,000, and a little money began to come in. However, the subscribers were not animated wholly by commercialism. After receiving just a little assurance that they might someday get their money back, they really got behind the deal. At 17 William Street, Newark, New Jersey, Henry had an office, which was the headquarters for our for a rapidly failing business. He also had a secretary named Ruth Hawk, who was to become one of AA's real pioneers. The other assets consisted of a huge desk and some plush furniture. Each morning, I traveled all the way from Brooklyn to Newark, where, pacing up and down in Henry's office, I began to dictate rough drafts of the chapters of the coming book. As we seemed unable to come up with any general outline for the publication, I worked from a hastily drawn up list of possible chapter headings. Week after week, Henry raced around among the stock subscribers, prodding them for their installments. In addition to this dribble of money, we were able to secure $2,500 from Mr. Charles Towns, who owned the hospital. Most of these funds had been devoted to office expenses and groceries for Henry, Ruth, Lois, and myself, and we kept going on this basis until April 1939, the publication date of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. As the chapters were slowly roughed out, I read them to the New York group at its weekly meetings in our parlor at Clinton Street, and copies were sent to Dr. Bob for checking and criticism in Akron, where we had nothing but the warmest support. But in the New York meeting, the chapters got a real mauling. I redictated them, and Ruth retyped them over and over. In spite of the heated arguments, the New York's criticisms did help a lot, and to some extent, their enthusiasm and confidence increased. So the job went on until we reached the famous Chapter 5. Up to that time, I had done my own story and had drafted three more chapters with the titles There Is a Solution, More About Alcoholism, and We Agnostics. It was now realized that we had enough background and window dressing material, and that at this point we would have to tell how our program for recovery from alcoholism really worked. The backbone of the book would have to be found right in there. This problem had secretly worried the life out of me. I had never written anything before, and neither had any other member of the New York group. Progress on the book had been too slow for several of the stock subscribers, and they had slacked off on their contributions. The hassling over four chapters already finished had really been terrific. I was exhausted. On many a day, I felt like throwing the book out of the window. I was in anything but spiritual mood on the night when the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous were written. I was sore and tired clear through. I lay in a bed at 182 Clinton Street with pencil in hand and with a tablet of scratch paper on my knee. I could not get my mind on the job, much less put my heart in it, but here was one of those things that had to be done. Slowly, my mind came into some kind of focus. Since Ebby's visit to me in the fall of 1934, we had gradually evolved what we called the word-of-mouth program. Most of the basic ideas had come from the Oxford groups, William James, and Dr. Silkworth. Though subject to considerable variations, it all boiled down into a pretty consistent procedure which comprised of six steps. These were approximately as follows. Number one, we admitted that we were licked, that we were powerless over alcohol. Two, made a moral inventory of our defects or sins. Three, we confessed and shared our shortcomings with another person in confidence. Four, we made restitution to all those we had harmed by our drinking. Five, we tried to help other alcoholics with no thought of reward in money or prestige. Six, we prayed to whatever God we thought there was for power to practice these precepts. This was the substance of what, by the fall of 1938, we were telling newcomers. Several of the Oxford group's other ideas and attitudes had definitely been rejected, including any which could involve us in theological controversy. In important matters, there was still, turn the page, the considerable disagreement over the Eastern and the Midwestern viewpoints. Our people out there were still active Oxford group members, while we in New York had withdrawn a year before. In Akron and vicinity, they still talked about the Oxford group's absolutes, absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. This dose was found to be too much for New Yorkers, and we had abandoned the expressions. But of all of us, East and West, were placing increasing emphasis on Dr. Silkworth's expression describing the alcoholic's dilemma, the obsession plus the allergy. By now, we knew from experience that the new prospect had to accept step one or get no place. So that's, again, just a little bit of a story, and it's a great story overall to be continued. Let me read to you now, just to give you another example. In our big book, it has chapter 5, How It Works. Some of us know that by heart. So for those of you that do, let me read to you what the original version in the big book was and see if you can identify the differences. Chapter 5, How It Works, first edition. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to follow directions. At some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that you are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as your program of recovery. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready that God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly, on our knees, asked him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual experience as the result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So again, there's some differences there, which are kind of interesting. Just wanted to share with you, too, I also, in my study, came across, you know how we talked about there being a third and fourth edition, and there's different stories. Sometimes the questions that we have in our program site, you know, read the story, you know, they lost it all on page whatever, but then that's not the same page in my book. There's actually information that you can find that shows you how to reconcile that. I love that. So I have a copy if anybody would like that. At this point, then, what I wanted to offer is that was my overview of the big book, and I wanted to give you guys the opportunity to look at the little bookmark that you have and to pick a topic. And if you wanted to pick a topic, I have the big book here. We can read from it, and we can have a couple minute time shares to make it interactive. I know when I'm sitting in a workshop, I like to, especially after lunch, it's hard when someone's reading to you. I know I would have fallen asleep long ago, but this will be a chance for you guys to share. So if you'd like to pick any topic, if you do want to share, just don't forget to sign in. So open for any topics or sharing. Gratitude Is there a page number referenced? 132. So the topic of gratitude on 132. Let's see what it says. We have been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic things. We have been dealing with alcohol in its worst aspect. But we aren't a glum lot. If newcomers could see no joy or fun in our existence, they wouldn't want it. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. We try not to indulge in cynicism over the state of nations, nor do we carry the world's troubles on our shoulders. When we see a man sinking into the mire that is alcoholism, we give him first aid and place what we have at his disposal. For his sake, we do recount and almost relive the horrors of our past. But those of us who have tried to shoulder the entire burden and trouble of others soon are overcome by them. So we think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. Outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over a seemingly tragic experience of our past. And why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered and have been given the power to help others. Would anyone like to share on that?
Hello, everyone. I'm Cheryl, recovering from compulsive eating.
Hi, Cheryl.
Okay, gratitude. I just have to express... share on gratitude because what this program has given to me, I really can't even repay it. And so I had an experience where someone had asked me to, like, I came to do get my service done, and I did. I reported for my service, but they didn't really need me at the particular time. And so then she had this other list of things for me to do, and it just really didn't fit in with my schedule, and I didn't want to make a commitment. But then after I really thought about it, I said, you know, I know that there is some type of service that I can do. So I just presented myself to her, and then she gave me another service job that kind of fits my personality a little bit better. That's selling raffle tickets. So if you guys need some raffle tickets, you know, just come up to me and I'll, you know, sell you some raffle tickets. But, yeah, that's just, you know, basically how it works. There's always, every meeting that I go to, I do look for an opportunity to be of service because I can, like I said earlier, I can never repay what this program has given to me. And by the grace of God, I'm really grateful that I had enough sense to even, like, accept the big book because in my old mind, I would probably not open up a big book, but you know, because this program, that's the book that we use, I'm so grateful that my higher power knew exactly what I needed. I mean, those stories, they just fit right in with my life. And when I listen to the meetings and listen to all of you and your stories, I'm like, wow, that person's a lot like I am, or you know, or was. And now, you know, I get the solutions to all of my problems. And I'm at a place in my recovery where I'm not ashamed of anything that happens to me because one thing I've learned in this program, it has happened to me, it has happened to you, and there's a solution. So talk it out, get it out, share about it, because I was an emotional wreck, as I stated earlier in one of my... I was a wreck when I came in here, and now I'm just loving myself today because of attitude adjustment, because of practicing the 12 steps, because of working, using the 7 tools on a day-by-day basics, and having all of you in the same situation that I'm in, and we're helping one another. That is just a beautiful place to be in mentally, spiritually, emotionally. The recovery that I get, I cannot pay back, so I try to do service wherever I go. So thank you so much for allowing me to share.
Thank you, Cheryl. Thank you. Anybody else want to share on gratitude or pick another topic? Please, Kim. Okay.
That's all good. That's all good.
Okay.
We're all part of it.
Okay, thanks. I'm Kim. I'm a compulsive eater.
Hi, Kim.
Thanks. And I have 3 things that are coming up that I'd just like to share. Number one is I had heard that there were some sponsors that encourage their sponsees to read the doctor's opinion every day. Some people like literally start their day with that. And so the only reason I say that is because you know, sometimes we just hear, for whatever strange reason, something that might be useful to us or a sponsor. And I started doing that. I did that for over 30 days, and it changed my recovery. It really did. And so I just offer that as a suggestion. It's really a powerful little tiny chapter in the book. The other thing, too, is just that on the paragraphs that Roberta just read on gratitude, there's a line in there that says something along the lines of, you know, we just lay these tools down in front of somebody, and, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but and that's really the best that we can do. And we can't force anybody. You know, you can just lead a horse to water, right? We cannot make them drink. And what that does for this compulsive eater is it says, I'm not responsible for you and your recovery. I'm just going to show you what is working for me. And if, you know, if you're interested in this, then here's what I do. Here are the tools of recovery that are working to produce this recovered person. And so it helps to take away, it's changed me at depth so that I don't feel responsible for every compulsive eater out there. And that's really hard, because there have been a lot of times recently, I would say in the last maybe 6 months, where I just feel like at every turn there's another really sick person, you know, really heavy into compulsive eating, who's bumped right up against me, and you know, we're in meetings together and I'm seeing them everywhere, and I'm just feeling like, oh, if you could just have a little bit of this. And this part of the book just reminds me, it is not my responsibility to save them. You know, it's something about, you've got a life ring and you toss it, and I just do the best I can. And what I really know is that the best thing I can do for that person is to continue to take care of myself and stay in my program and continue recovery. It's the best. Everybody wins when this person stays abstinent and stays in program and keeps just doing the next right thing for me. So that's the best thing I can do for my family. That's the best thing I can do for another compulsive eater. That's the best thing I can do for this world. And so, I think I'll end with that. So thanks for giving me an opportunity to share tonight.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you. Hi, everyone. I am Alicia, and I come from Salt Lake City, Utah.
Hi, Alicia.
Hello. So for me, the important thing when it comes to gratitude is a balance. And the way I think of that is two ways. One is that if there is something that is bothering me, it's very important to put that out of the way when it comes to communicating with my higher power or communicating with one of you. To put that out of the way, and then I can begin looking what I'm grateful for. So, for instance, if something happened at work or with my family that it's bothering me, this sick mind has a tendency to only look at that. And so I have to put it in writing. I have to put in writing that little part that didn't go well or the way I wanted. And then I get to also list all the things that went well, either with something I did or with something that happened. And that just keeps me honest, because unless I see all parts as honest as I can, to me, sometimes being grateful and trying to hide something that is bothering me, it's not the balance that I want to have in my life. So, you know, every day is a new reminder that it's a new beginning, and I get to see the wonder that each one of you is, and the wonder that I'm hoping that little by little I can cultivate with the help of my higher power and the help of all of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Alicia. Again, anyone can share or put up a new topic?
Hi, I'm Gloria, compulsive obeda.
Hi, Gloria.
I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here, but I kind of had an aha moment today. Somebody was up sharing. They were giving their story, and they said something about 22 years. And I don't know, some of y'all know me, but I've been around about 24 years. I came through a OA house. And when she shared that and then having 3 years of back-to-back absence, something in my spirit said, it's time. It's time. Because I noticed that every year close to this time, maybe 6 months prior to this time, I have a slip. And something said, it's time. It's time to stop running. I got work for you. And what I'm thankful and grateful for is I can hear that now, that I'm clean and I'm sober, and I can hear that voice saying, stop running, child. Stop running. I got something for you. And the program has been a miracle for me. My gratitude is so, I'm just so grateful. I'm just so full of acceptance and knowing that it's time. It's time for me to do what God has me to do. And whatever that is, today, I'm willing to listen to the next step. So thank you.
Thank you, Gloria. Thank you. Anybody else want to share either on that topic or pick another topic and we can read out of the big book? Please. Thanks. Thanks, sweetie.
Being 80 feet tall, I'm Lisa, compulsive eater.
And I'm Lisa.
I chose gratitude as a topic because I have an illness of chronic depression, major depression. And when I'm down, I look to gratitudes to bring me up. I look to, I do this thing with myself. If I feel like I'm not up to par or I don't like myself or whatever it is, I dress the opposite of how I feel. So I wear whatever will make me feel happy, joyous, and free. But I really responded in that reading to where they said, we absolutely insist on being happy. You know, isn't that amazing? I absolutely insist on being happy. And for the first time in my life, thanks to CHOW, 5 years and is all I've been in. More than a year and a half now of back-to-back abstinence, but I'm just so peaceful and happy. And you know, somebody said today on the panel about how they were. They always had all this drama in their lives and everything, and I was thinking, so did I. I just went from chaos and crisis to the next thing, and I all of a sudden realized I'm not doing it. You know, isn't that amazing? I'm just being now. So that's all I've got. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you. Give me the page number. Okay, let's do freedom, 553.
Freedom.
Yeah, freedom. 553, this is one of the stories. AA taught him to handle sobriety. And there's a quote, God willing, we may never again have to deal with drinking, but we have to deal with sobriety every day. When I had been in AA only a short while, an old timer told me something which has affected me all my life ever since. AA does not teach us how to handle our drinking. It teaches us how to handle sobriety. I guess I always knew that the way to handle my drinking was to quit. After my very first drink, a tiny glass of sherry my father gave me to celebrate the new year when I was 13, I went up to bed dizzy and with exhilaration and excitement, and I prayed I wouldn't drink anymore. But I did when I reached college age. Much later, when I progressed to full-blown alcoholism, people told me I should quit. Like most other alcoholics I had known, I did quit drinking at various times, once for 10 months on my own and during other interludes when I was hospitalized. It's no great trick to stop drinking. The trick is to stay stopped. To do that, I had to come to AA to learn how to handle sobriety, which is what I could not handle in the first place, and that's why I drank. That's very cool.